Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hardcore is a new series from Heritage Radio Network. Over six episodes, we're taking a close look at the rebirth of American cider.
Really, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that cider started to be revitalized in the United States.
From the science of fermentation.
So yeast, it's a fungus. It's a unicellular fungus.
To the magic of terroir.
What really excites us is thinking about communicating that very sort of spiritual aspect of knowing a piece of land.
We're setting aside our cider donuts to gain a deeper understanding of this singular beverage.
I love a cider donut. You don't have to have a cider donut with your cider, and I will die on that point.
Subscribe to Hardcore wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guests today are Brandon Dong and Brian Pollen, co-owners of Brooklyn Kura, the first sake brewery in New York, which opened in 2017 at the Industry City in Brooklyn. They joined us on episode 105 and discussed why and how they created the sake brewery in New York, the sake-making philosophy, among many other things. Since then, Brooklyn Kura is growing steadily and very successfully. You may have seen their sake at your favorite Japanese restaurants and your local retailers. So today, we'll talk about the distinctively unique style of sake, new sake production methods that they're exploring right now, and fascinating collaboration with a traditional Japanese sake brewery, Nambubijin, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokataima.com. Now let's start a conversation with Brandon Dong and Brian Pollen. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us back.
So it's exciting to see how successful you are now. Yeah, so when you came join us, it's like just the beginning of everything started.
That's very generous of you. We've got a lot of work to do.
Right. We discussed all about what you're working on today. But first of all, for listeners who have not listened to episode 105, tell us about your background and why you guys decided to open the sake brewery.
Yeah, so my background is in research science.
Mm-hmm. This is Brandon.
Yeah. I helped develop drugs for cancer and heart disease, which is, you know, pretty logical and straightforward. So I had hobbies to sort of just play around, and one of those was fermenting things, mm-hmm. Particularly beer. So that was a way for me to, like, kind of balance the science. And
I used to work for American Express. I managed a product and technology organization, and before that I was effectively a statistician. sake is this extraordinary thing that we've both had exposure to over at different points in our lives, and then kind of in meeting in Japan, and we discussed this quite a bit last time, and seeing the craftsmen that make sake and tasting local sake. It was just a matter of time and being able to try to do it in our homes and then extend that into a business, which we've been fortunate enough to do.
Right. Interesting, right? It's like, who would imagine to open a sake brewery in New York, considering your background? So,
yeah, I mean, I think that we like our backgrounds are very complementary, and it's really helped us.
Right, and you met at a friend's wedding, right? So yeah. That's like, you know, the star aligned.
I mean, it was a bizarre wedding too. It was a Hindu wedding in Tokyo. So, lots of things. That were kind of fun about that whole experience.
Right. Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book about how it was born and everything in maybe 10 years. Okay, so the theme of the Brooklyn Kura is American craft sake inspired by brewed in Brooklyn. So sorry, repeat. American craft sake inspired by tradition brewed in Brooklyn. So so based on that, so how many sakes do you produce right now?
Well, we have two that we produce a lot of, our Junmai Blue Door and our Junmai Ginjo number 14. But in our tap room, we also have six taps and maybe sometimes some bottles down below. We really want to try and present people with a spectrum of different kinds of sake. And also, you know, we're 2 years old and we're still learning a lot about sake. So we want to explore different styles and learn different techniques. And the tap room is a great way for us to show that off.
Mm.
There are some good examples among distilleries, craft beer breweries, wineries, where, I mean, there are things that are broadly distributed by these companies, but the tap room is a place of experimentation. So in designing and thinking through the sake brewery, we wanted to mirror that experience for consumers, especially given our product is relatively new to many of them.
Mm. Right. So the number 14 and Blue Door, which I tasted many times and I love it, both of them, but they are more fairly traditional style, right? And then at the tap room, last time I went was in July. And before that, there was an interesting sake called Occidental. And that turned to be pink.
Yes.
And it was
we do. We are on the more traditional side. We want to make sure that we're introducing sake to people, you know, like as it is in Japan. But that said, we also do experiment and do things a little outside of tradition. So Occidental is one of those. It's a Junmai that we really lightly dry hop. And it's interesting because the sake will take on some of the green of the hops. But over time, that changes to sort of a light pink and then eventually a deep red. And so that's been like a favorite of people's.
Right.
Yeah, when we... when we decided to do this, especially in a place like Brooklyn in proximity to some of the best restaurants and kind of the greatest density of great food and drink in the country, let alone the world, we knew we needed to be producing something that would be respected by people who had experience consuming some of the best sakes produced in Japan. And so proving that we can make something traditional or classical gives us some latitude to kind of get creative and not weird, but things that we think enhance the experience of drinking sake, and I still have a core of like a traditional dish, delicious sake as a base.
Right. I think I always respect Brandon's scientific background because it's not kind of, it could be a playful experiment, but it's a solid base that you're not going to go off the cliff. That's my feeling about your products.
Nothing has come out of that brewery that, like, we really haven't been proud of. It's been pretty remarkable to see him make things at the scale that we are, and at the quality that we produce with the limited experience that we practically have making sake.
I want to discuss more creative versions in a minute, but one of the items that you serve at Tap Room is vintage, which is old school Junmai Ginjo. So what do you mean by old school?
I mean, that's just the description comes from the yeast that we use in that. we have that in the tap room once in a while, and it's one of the yeasts we have that is one of the oldest sake yeasts that we could possibly get. So we're just, it's just a play on the name and referring to a very old strain of yeast. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's been, like, for so many decades now, there's been a movement to more modern yeasts for, like, ginjo and danginjo to have these certain tastes in the sake and move away from things that were more acidic in the past. But now there seems to be a little bit of a trend of some higher acidity sakes, some sakes that can go a little better with bigger meals. So I think that sake, you know, fits that bill.
Right. So I think yeast is becoming more creative, increasingly, even in Japan, like, you know, flour, fruit, everything. And so the traditional yeast, how many traditional yeast are there?
I don't know if anybody's added that up. Each prefecture tends to have their own yeast. And then, like, sometimes there's breweries in Japan where they only use the ambient yeast that's within the brewery. So that there might be countless different yeasts available.
The sake industry in Japan depends very much on this, like, central organization, which does take responsibility for maintaining quality control over, like, yeasts that are broadly used in sake production. But there are also other companies that cultivate yeasts that are designed to produce delicate, delicious sakes that we can work with as well.
Right. Is it because of, you know, in the whole worldwide, there's, like, craft breweries, craft everything. So do you think companies who supply yeast tend to be more creative and the more variations available?
What I'd say is, I think it's like one of the critical inputs in the process. So, like, if you don't have a high-quality thing that is responsible for creating the esters, aromas, texture, and eventual alcohol of your beverage, then it's really going to be difficult to produce something of quality. So these are kind of companies and organizations that spend a lot of care and attention to make sure that they're supplying the best quality product, and their product in many respects is yeast.
Right, so sake basically is made out of water, rice, yeast, and koji, and human, like Brendan. So, like, the professional skills. So, yeah, it's very important to have the right yeast and the combination of yeast and koji. Speaking of koji is now keyword for many people and chefs to regular consumers. And thanks to you, I got to know Koichi Higuchi.
Oh, great.
He's awesome.
Yeah, koji spore supplier. And he joined us in the conversation in the studio too. But so what's your choice for koji? Like, are there many variations of koji, like yeast?
Yeah, there might be more variations of koji than there are yeast. Koji kin, or the spores that we use, because we grow our own koji. But the koji kin is the only ingredient that we exclusively get from Japan, and that's because nobody else makes it. So we do, like Higuchi's koji, we use a few others. And that's something that's, on my learning curve to learn more about. But it is really important to grow koji well. So it's not something I've been experimenting with too much. That said, we have one other koji we've been growing that is also used in awamori. And it produces a lot of citric acid. And when you use that koji to make a sake, you get like a really tart, a different kind of sourness than lactic acid. You get, like, more citrus sour.
Oh, so that's the black koji?
Yes.
Out of white, yellow, black. The black is only
black.
Used for making awamori.
Yeah.
Right. And is that what it is that, your tap room, citrix?
Yeah.
That's the sake name made with
black. Yeah, we're calling it koji sour.
Wow. So that's this.
That's a sake where about half of all the koji that goes into it is this black koji, and it has like a really bright, refreshing kind of acidity to it.
Wow. So maybe that's the one I tried when I last time I visited. It's like almost like wine, clean white wine, but distinctively, you sense the sake note as well. So I was fascinated.
That's amazing.
Yeah. What's the formula though? First, you determine yeast or koji, or how does it work?
Just putting a batch together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing we do is we grow koji, and that takes about 2 days. And that is about 20% of all the rice that goes into a batch.
Mm.
And the point of koji is to provide the enzymes that will convert the starch of the rice into sugar that the yeast will then eat. So that's one of the most fascinating things about sake, is that you need two organisms to produce it. It's different than wine, where all the sugar is already in the grape, and beer, where you just mash the grains to get your sugar. And then the other fascinating thing is, once we put a batch together, we're sort of making that sugar and the yeast is consuming it at the same time.
Mm.
So there's two variables that you have to kind of like encourage or discourage so that, you know, your batch will come out nice. And then, you know, we put all those four ingredients together, and the sake ferments very cold for about a month. And then it gets pressed to separate the leftover rice, or the kasu, from the cleared sake. We mostly serve a style called nama-nama, which is unpasteurized sake.
Mm.
So after the sake settles a little bit, we just bottle it.
Mm. So that's a huge advantage of having American brewery here, because nama is very limited from Japan, because it has to be pasteurized to survive the transportation. So that's... I really appreciate it. In terms of, you know, for your tap selections, do you try to use new yeast, because you constantly like to find new flavor, like your craft sake made in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of work to make sort of our mainstays. That takes a lot of our time. So when we do have time to make something new, you know, it's. We have an idea that comes from maybe talking from some tochis in Japan, or sometimes talking to beer or winemakers here, and just come up with an idea of something to make and see if it comes out well.
Right. So I heard you are exploring new products with different kind of yeast koji, and also Kimoto. Kimoto is a... You can explain what Kimoto is, but that's kind of... You only mainly create Junmai Ginjo, and then one Junmai, that's the Blue Door, and then Kimoto. That's a challenge.
Yeah, so Kimoto is an old style of brewing. Almost all sake is Sokucho, which means at the very beginning of the batch, you add a small amount of lactic acid to lower the pH and sort of make a safe space for the yeast.
Mm.
And that allows the yeast to grow up without competition and to be a strong fermenter of the whole batch. So a long time ago, before people knew about yeast or microorganisms, people would just combine koji rice and water together and let it, and you know, stir it and let it sit for about a month. And then the natural lactic acid bacteria in the air would lower the pH, and then it would become sort of a safe place for yeast.
Mm.
So about a year ago, we made our first Kimoto, it's been in cold storage for a year, and pretty soon we'll release it.
Mm. So what do you think is the benefit of Kimoto?
It's fascinating to try these other techniques. I think it lends a little more of a heavier taste, like a little bit of a more funky taste to it.
Because more natural.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it's good to sort of add to the spectrum of sakes that we offer.
Wow. I can't. Well, let me know. Thanks, Ray. I would just definitely come and try it. And so also heard that you're producing sparkling sakes made by a combination of wine and sake making methods. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's still in experimental stages, but we are you want to talk about it, Brian?
I mean, it gets back, like, why do we make Kimotos? Why do we have the koji sour? It's like there's such a range of different ways to experience sake. And, I mean, people that like to drink, like, things across the spectrum. And sparkling sake can be made in a bunch of different ways. And one of the things we like to flex every once in a while is to to attempt different techniques. So we all enjoy bubbly things, and bubbly sake is one of them, especially the stuff that's made by the AWA organization or members of the AWA organization in Japan. And so we're kind of doing our first riff on sparkling sake, which is a combination of champagne methods, traditional methods. It's kind of using the, like, kind of fully accepting the constraints we have in our production process, and trying to kind of use bottle fermentation or bottle conditioning as a mechanism to get the consistency.
Right. So you make the base sake and then bottle it and add sugar, or the what's the thing? Because it's a champagne method is that for listeners, it's like...
Yeah. It's a little more on the PetNat side. There's a chance that this might not work out, so we might be talking about it too
soon. It's going to work out.
I love that.
It's definitely going to work out.
But what we did is we stopped a batch of sake before it was finished, when it was still had sugar and it was still sweet. And at that point, then we introduced some champagne yeast. And then we've been monitoring it. And honestly, I think tomorrow we'll bottle it. So we're trying to capture the beverage right at the right amount of sugar so that it will end up producing the right amount of carbonation.
So in instances like this, we debate how much bubbles should be there when we open it, like the celebratory champagne experience or like your everyday PetNat. I think the experience, the celebratory experience of a sparkling wine, but in the context of sake, is something we both enjoy, like, and expect people to enjoy. The fact that it's bottle conditioned, the fact that it's a combination of like champagne method, traditional method, sparkling winemaking, is something that I'm excited to have a conversation about with the people who carry our sake or potentially would want to, as an easy thing for them to introduce to their customers and say, here's a sake that kind of feels like and is presented similarly to the PetNats that you're falling in love with. And it's made with the care and attention and a very kind of relevant but traditional method. So it's super exciting.
So the difference between the yeast used for sake and for the champagne, what's the difference? Sorry, I just get into the
so I mean, if you look at sort of like the family tree of yeast that are used to ferment things in general, Saccharomyces cerevisiae has sort of three main branches. It's got beer, wine, and sake, and these they're the same species, but they have sort of been sort of like a selective evolution because of the places where people were using them. So if you think about it in Japan, sake brewing in Japan is a winter affair largely. And it was, you know, when fishermen and farmers had time off, they would, in the winter, they'd make sake. So you need a yeast that can ferment at very cold temperatures and then can get the alcohol levels they wanted. So over hundreds, if not thousands of years in Japan, people were selecting the yeast that worked for them. And that's how that branch differentiates between wine and beer.
So that means, and wine's made in a warmer temperature, the summertime, fall. So that makes sense. So isn't it really risky to use that summer yeast during the winter time, or whatever regardless when you eat?
Yeah, I mean, there's also champagne yeast. They will cellar champagne yeast, and so it can see cold temperatures, and champagne yeast does work at a surprisingly cold temperature. So there's like a little bit of crossover between how these two yeasts, you know, kind of evolved. So
actually champagne is pretty north, so the region is right. So that's interesting. I've never heard of it, the combining different families of yeast.
I don't think it's unique to what we're doing. I think you're starting to see Japanese breweries, even though the share of like the market for sparkling like sake is very, very small. You're starting to see these breweries experiment with champagne-like processes across the board, and that's really what the AWA kind of consortium is supporting, rules around that style of sparkling sake. And then you see places like ours, where not only do you have to get to play with different types of yeast, but you can also play with different koji compositions to give a little bit more bite and acidity to stand up to the kind of the sparkles, the dissolved CO2 as well.
Fascinating. So, yeah, because what are you guys doing? Very inspiring to Japanese breweries, too. So, yeah, it's expanding totally the scope of sake making.
We talk about this all the time. We're in New York, and we benefit because of that. Pretty much anyone who sells sake to the U.S., 90% sell their sake to New York City. Mm. And then among those breweries or our brewery employees, when they visit the U.S. market, they tend to come to New York City. Mm. And as a result, because we're familiar and a brewery here, they come to visit us. So so they get to inspire us on a regular basis.
Right.
And we're very lucky.
So speaking of that global exchange, so I heard about the interesting collaboration with the Nambu Bijin. So let's talk about it. So how did it happen in the first place?
How did we first meet Nambu Bijin?
Nambu Bijin has a very strong relationship with our friends, Chizuko Helton and Sake Discoveries.
Yes. Oh, by the way, Nambu Bijin is in Iwate Prefecture and one of the most, biggest award-winning, amazing sake brewery.
And I think it was through introductions from Chizuko and Jessica Jolly with Nambu Bijin early in our process of kind of starting the brewery that has resulted in not only a fast friendship and kind of like, let's say, practical support to our process and our brewery's development, but also the potential for a collaboration like this.
Right. So then I heard that Brandon went to visit the brewery and what happened?
He had a great experience there.
I showed up very excited to work with them and promptly got food poisoning and was out of commission. But, I'm totally indebted to Nambu Bijin forever because they took care of me. They coordinated everything and got me back home.
You got really seriously ill,
yes, I
heard.
Yes, I had a fascinating and an awesome experience with socialized medicine in Japan.
So that means you couldn't work with them at the brewery.
No, so we took a rain check. And the rain check was, Nambu Bijin has two tochis. And they came out the beginning of the summer, and we put together our first daiginjo. We've held off on making a daiginjo, I think, because we just wanted to make sure that we could make a junmai, ginjo. So this is a great opportunity with Matsumori-san and Tamakawa-san, arguably two of the best tojis in the world. So it was fairly intimidating for them to come out to our small two-year-old brewery. It was pretty humbling.
But that's amazing. They came to visit.
They came, they shoveled rice, they picked up steam rice, put it on the koji table. They kind of articulated how they propagate tane on koji. They were awesome. They talked about fermentation profile and temperature, yeast selection, and they're just like, but it's not dissimilar to the craft brewing culture in the U.S. It's like a bunch of really talented craftspeople coming together and just talking about things that they do to make their stuff tasty.
Right.
It's like that simple in many respects.
So people might imagine Japanese tradition taught to new innovative American. That's the picture, but it sounds like it's more collaborative, like both ways, in a way.
I don't know about both ways.
In this instance, it's more what I think what we can inspire is that we're blank slate. We want to make things we like and that people enjoy with respect. So that flexibility, we're not a 10th generation brewery with expectations in a market and like a style that's known. It's like we're like, oh, this is good. Let's try and do it. And so I think that's inspirational the other direction. But practically speaking, these are expert craftsmen that produce a range of different qualities on a scale we can barely conceive of coming and sitting in our 1,250 square feet or whatever, 1,750 square feet and like working with us.
It's like a mentorship almost in that sense.
Yeah.
The president, Kosuke Kuji, he's an amazing person. He's such a giver always. And so that makes sense that they come.
Yeah, Kuji-san is like a global cheerleader of sake. Mm. So, you know, and he's also has the right philosophy, you know, to invite us to Iwate and teach us what they can to come out and collaborate. Mm. What he's doing is getting more people excited about sake. Mm. Our success benefits them because more people get into sake. And if somebody comes in and has sake, our sake in New York for the first time, they might want to go explore sake, you know, which is a deep rabbit hole. And I think that, you know, like, I think that's one of the reasons we've had such a positive response from breweries in Japan.
Mm. Hey, so the bigger the pie, the more
exactly
fun. And
And the pie needs to grow. Right. It is shrinking in Japan pretty quickly.
That's a great point. Yeah, so did you make the Daiginjo, you said? So is it done, or?
It's done and it's sold out.
Oh,
It turned out really well. We were very happy with it.
Really?
We've called it Brooklyn Bijin. So Nabu Bijin, it means southern beauty. It refers to their rice. Mm. So our collaboration is Brooklyn Beauty.
Right. Hopefully it's going to come out again. You're going to make it again?
Yes. It exceeded all of our expectations.
Wow.
It was really, like, delicious.
Mm.
We'll definitely make it again.
Right. Because it's your first Daiginjo, so.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And so what do you think about collaboration? You know, the global collaboration. Do you think it's going to be more happening?
It has to. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we're going to move backward from our experience. More and more people are starting to make sake. Those people are increasingly interested in involving Japanese breweries and producers and craftsmen in their efforts. And so, I mean, books are starting to be translated more regularly, like educational programs supporting both industry, like people up and down the kind of the vertical industry are becoming more available. And so, we should be collaborating more.
Mm.
And so it's just about finding the time to do that.
Right. So speaking of American breweries, so there are other sake breweries in the U.S., even they started before you guys started. And do you know how many right now?
There is about 15 last count, I think.
Okay. Wow. So what are they very different in terms of style?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a big spectrum, particularly in the United States right now. And they range from people on the very traditional end to more experimental. And so I think it's a good spectrum early on to see. I mean, you know, sometimes America will take something from another culture and destroy it. Sometimes you get things out of it, like a California Merlot or an American IPA, which you can find all over the world now. So there has to be a period of sort of mixing it up for a little while and shake out and see what stays. So it'll be interesting to see how it evolves.
I mean, I think a lot of these breweries, even if they're producing different things with different resources and goals, they're talking about sake in a pretty common language, right? So they're educating people who are buying their things or visiting their spaces, people about, oh, this is a Junmai style, and maybe we fruit it or we don't, or maybe we ferment it warmer than, that's almost secondary.
Mm.
Even these alternative spaces are points of education for all consumers about, like, traditional Japanese sake.
Right. Yeah, and we talked earlier, Koji is now becoming, like, keyword. So I heard about beer breweries using, you know, sake elements, including Koji. And it's really just exciting how many different flavors we can enjoy maybe in the next 3-5 years.
Yeah, I think, beer breweries, it's getting pretty competitive, and I think they're all looking for, like, the next IPA or what's going to be the next thing. And, you know, we encourage them to look at sake because there's a whole bunch of different things that they could, you know, involve with beer baking.
Right. So let's see what's going to happen. And, I'll book you in 3 years and tell you what you think.
Sure.
So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Brooklyn Kura's sustainable partnerships with restaurants. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese broadcasting from live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests today are Brandon Thorne and Brian Pollan, co-owners of Brooklyn Kura, the very first sake brewery in New York, which opened in 2017. So, where do you sell your sake right now? Are you selling beyond New York?
Slow and steady. Mm. You can find us in a few surprising places, but the primary place that we're starting to sell more in is in California. Mm. So we are in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York. California is a place that we're investing more time and energy in, and maybe soon you'll find us in Germany and Sweden.
That'd be awesome.
We're hopeful. But I mean, our sake has made it to Japan. It was in some great restaurants in Hong Kong for a little while. And yeah, we're just slowly kind of finding our footing in some of these new markets. Mm.
So where does that demand come from, you think? I mean, like, interesting and it's unique.
So I think the demand comes from people have an interest in things that are Japanese in general. And they're also, to Brandon's earlier point, interested in kind of new, exciting things that they can bring into their lives and, like, upon interest, like, learn more and more about. Mm. And so sake fits that bill. And so when we go to a market like Los Angeles, there are people who are passionate about sake or natural wine or craft beer that are like, oh, I'm going to talk to this person mm-hmm. who represents a local producer of a thing that I'm interested in. And then it's like they drink it and they taste it and they introduce it to their customers. And once they can do that, I mean, it just like kind of creates a real like lasting relationship. Mm. So one major part of it is being present in a market and talking to people about what we're doing and why. Mm. Another major part of it is like sharing with them the quality of what we're able to produce, mm. its consistency, and kind of making a commitment to honor that quality and consistency throughout the course of our relationship.
Right. So the sake market in the States is kind of known, very competitive, but it's not because you are, I mean, of course you are local, people like local stuff, especially exactly. those days, but of course the quality, and you said like it's a presence, you have to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, there are a large number of sake breweries that send sake to the U.S., all of which, I mean, there's a range in styles and flavors, all of which are wonderful. We do have a distinct advantage of being local and also being recognizable. And so it's an easier thing in many respects to communicate to people who are new to sake mm. than some of the traditional labels that have been out in right. the market.
Oh, speaking of the label, I think you guys' labels are very cool.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's like a very modern, and you wonder, what is this? So, yeah, I think it's very cool.
That's awesome.
So, are you thinking of selling your sake in Japan?
So, yes. I mean, we're just trying to scale our production and service the U.S. There is a lot of romance, and it would feel good to be in Japan, but I think we will get there once it would be an affordable thing for people to purchase in Japan. Mm. Right now, if we were to send it on smaller scale, it'd just be this very luxury thing that, right. like, we really... We have some partnerships in the future. Brooklyn Brewery is opening up a tap room in Tokyo, and we expect our sake to be a part of that. That experience, and then slowly we'll bleed out into a broader, broader footprint.
That's a very Brooklyn collaboration. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, they're great.
Do you know when they're gonna open?
I do not know what they've communicated, so no.
Okay.
It's a media savvy answer.
Right. How do you keep up with the increased distribution?
I mean, originally we were driving cases of sake around New York City, and that was limiting for a bunch of different reasons. Now we have great partners. So we work with a really well-respected, family-owned fine wine distributor that has a large sake portfolio, Polaner, and they have representation in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And so being on their team has been really rewarding for us, and that helps us kind of grow a little faster. And then nationally, we work with Vine Connections, which has a very deep experience in sake and sake sales nationally, and has some pretty awesome brands. And so,
And then Monica Samuels, exactly. Who's the ambassador. She came, spoke about what she does. It's amazing.
I mean, she is like a force to be reckoned with. She's so knowledgeable and has so much energy focused on kind of increasing the size of the sake market in the U.S. So that's helpful too. And then, like I said, we have to be physically present. I mean, we're not just a bottle. I mean, we are trying to build relationships with people, get feedback from them continuously, and then like be a sake that they can have confidence is going to be like as good as we can make it.
Right. Yeah, you guys have a really good story to tell. So I think being a present is the hardest, probably. Once you're there, you can talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And also, you have a lot of sake kasu, which is sake li, and of course, koji with other, excess koji. So I heard you have some partnerships with the restaurants. And
yeah, I mean, we would like to use 100% of our kasu. I mean, there should be no waste in that process. And so we work with places ranging from Blue Hill to Ivan Ramen, from Oxalis to Red Paper Clip. And many of them do to a chocolatier in Greenpoint. I mean, many of them use our kasu for a range of different things, from pickling to making sauces to making breads and pizza doughs. And it's like all stuff that if we had the time, would be fun to experiment with, but we really don't.
Right. One thing magical about koji is the sweet, like a natural sweet. And after tasting so koji sweetness, sugar tastes like a fake, in my opinion. So I think there's a lot of way to use it.
You're a little biased.
Yeah, I am, totally. So what's your plan for this busy holiday season coming up?
I mean, I think we're going to be open and doing what we do, which is trying to make great sake and educate people. It's not, hopefully we'll sell a bunch more sake over the holiday season, but that's really, I mean, we're going to be present, making sake, serving it there for our customers. I'm probably going to be in California. Brandon's planning a trip to Japan soon. It's like no change other than just continuing to be focused on what we do.
Right. That'd be cool for New Year's Eve. Sake is going to be regular drink. Yeah.
Sparkling sake soon.
Right?
I should add, we do have like this, a few events. We're working with this group called Union Sushi Co. that works with exclusively sustainable fish and fisheries. And they're doing an omakase at Brooklyn Kura.
Right.
We're doing an event with the master blender from New Belgium, presenting our sakes right next to their like extraordinary sour beers, with these really talented chefs on December 5th. I mean, we have a monthly educational session that we do, which is all about learning the basics of sake in the context of the brewery. I mean, so we are trying to stay busy too.
So why are you going to Japan, Brandon?
I like to try and go every winter and just visit different breweries and just see and learn as much as I can.
Nice. So are you going to work at some of those places?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll put me to work.
Right. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's cool.
Right. So I think the psychic community is pretty close and very cohesive. So I think it's a good thing that you go there and then you bridge Japanese and American breweries. So yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. And so where can we find all the information about with Brooklyn Kura?
I mean, you can go onto our website. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook, sometimes Twitter.
Okay.
but mostly Instagram. You can email us anytime at info@brooklynkura.com. You can call us. I mean, we're here.
You can come to the tap room.
Yeah, that's even better.
Yeah, so when is the tap room open?
So we're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evening times. We're probably going to extend those hours soon. And then, like I mentioned, we have private events, holiday parties, corporate events happening throughout throughout the week.
Right. So it's in Industry City.
It is.
Brooklyn. And so what time do you start serving at the tap room?
So on Fridays, we start serving at about 4:30. On Saturdays at 1 o'clock. On Sundays at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, last time I was there, so busy.
Yeah. I mean, our area is growing. A lot more places are opening up. You can get hometown barbecue across the courtyard from us.
Right. Yeah, it's Industry City is full of interesting, delicious food shops. So
yeah, in addition to food shops, there are a lot of craftspeople there that are making some extraordinary products, both on the food and beverage side, but also just like weavers and photographers. It's a pretty neat community of people.
Right. So, well, good luck. And looking forward to having you back again to give us your update.
All right. Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests and topics of the show, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.